Welcome to Melbourne University Up Close, a fortnightly podcast of research, personalities and cultural offerings of the University of Melbourne, Australia. Up Close is available on the web at upclose.unimelb.edu.au. That's upclose.unimelb.edu.au.
Hello and welcome to Up Close from the studios of the University of Melbourne, Australia. I'm Eric Van Bemmel. Whatever happened to the WTO, the World Trade Organization? Created to coordinate and liberalize trade among the world's economically diverse nations, it's more recently become not only an object of scorn for those opposing globalization, but in the eyes of some free trade pundits, an impediment to free trade itself. At 13 years of age, the WTO is struggling to remain an important part of the global trade landscape as it comes under fire for its failure to pass increasingly ambitious trade liberalization measures and for its perceived treatment of developing nations. So does the World Trade Organization have relevance, and can it play a meaningful role in the future of multilateral trade arrangements? The Warwick Commission, based at the University of Warwick in the UK, took on the task over most of 2007 of examining the WTO and its methods and functions with a view to recommending ways in which the world body might reassert itself as an effective proponent and arbiter of global multilateral trade. Joining me in the studio to discuss the WTO's plight and ways it might positively reinvent itself is University of Melbourne political scientist and Warwick Commission member Professor Anne Capling. Professor Capling's research interests include trade policy, multilateral trade, and global economic governance. And the WTO, the World Trade Organization, for many of us, it's a bit of an arcane sort of dry and abstract sort of topic, and it's not one that we sort of pour over the newspaper with a lot of glee. And I guess I'll be asking you to make it a bit juicy for us today, if that's all right. I spoke in the intro about it being in a bit of a quandary at the moment, the WTO. Things are a bit stagnating, and I'll ask you to expand on that in a moment. But I thought I'd ask first to give us a bit of a potted history of the WTO and its predecessors.
Of course, the WTO was established in 1995, and as you said in your introduction, it's only 13 years old, but in fact, the multilateral trade system has a much longer history. And at risk of giving a bit of a history lesson, it is useful to start that way. Mm. Certainly, the origins of the multilateral trade system go back to the end of World War II. With the establishment of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or the GATT. I'm very sorry, but trade is an area that has many acronyms, and I'll try not to use any of them as we talk today.
You could sprinkle a few around if you like.
But there had been this sort of golden period of relative free trade among nations, beginning in the late 19th century. But in the 1930s, partly as a result of the Great Depression, and partly as World War II loomed, the world fragmented into highly protectionist and competing trade blocs. And not only did that not solve the problems that it was meant to address, namely trying to end the Depression, but many economic historians and politicians at the time actually thought that it contributed to the causes of World War II. Hmm. And so even when the war was on, the planners among the Allied countries were trying to figure out how to solve this problem of how to prevent a return to the Depression after the war, and how to have some sort of way of ensuring that nations could cooperate with each other. And really, the architecture that they established, and this was at the same time that they were also establishing the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, was the architecture for the multilateral trade system. Now, the most important features of the GATT at the time, and here's where we get a little bit technical, but I'll try not to be boring. The first thing was the idea of non-discrimination. So in any kind of trade negotiation, if you offered a concession, if you offered to reduce the level of protection that you had against a certain country's imports, for instance, you would multilateralize that. You would offer it to all of your trade partners or all the members of the GATT. This is at the heart of the multilateral trade system, this notion that whatever you do for your best trading partner, you do for everybody else.
And I should treat your goods as if they were mine, in terms of there should be no discrimination between
them. And that's the other part, exactly. No discrimination once the product arrives, and no discrimination amongst the sources of the product.
Right.
That was only a small part of it, though. That was a crucial part. Another of its purposes was to start to liberalize trade through trade negotiations. So the idea was that nations would periodically get together and through a bargaining situation, trade what we called concessions with each other. I will reduce my tariffs on wool if you reduce your tariffs on cars, for instance. And so, and then again, though the results of those became multilateralized. So this is where these all in sort of multi-nation bargaining sessions that we call trade rounds began. But another important aspect of the GATT was this whole idea that it provided a forum for nations to negotiate rules with each other. And there was a notion that international rules were really important, especially to protect the weaker countries. You know, the major powers could always fend for themselves in a stoush. You know, they have the economic clout or the political power or the market size to be able to sort of, you know, have their way.
Yes.
And the idea of having rules was really, in a sense, to restrain the use of that power. And it's a protection of the smaller countries, of the weaker countries in the trade system. And then last but not least, there was the idea that the GATT would provide a place where nations could settle their differences. When they had a trade dispute, they could take it to the GATT and have it heard and resolved in, you know, a non-political situation.
Yes.
So the GATT was very successful up until the early 1990s. There were seven rounds of multilateral trade negotiations, and there was very significant trade liberalization in goods achieved during this time. And there's all sorts of calculations around about what its contribution was to overall welfare. But it also suffered from a number of defects. The defects of the GATT really, and the success of the last GATT round, the Uruguay round, which was held between 1986 and 1994, that led to the establishment of the World Trade Organization in 1995.
And I was going to ask you about that because that was an important round. You had what was called the Grand Bargain.
Yes.
That sounds very highfalutin. What's that?
It was an extraordinary achievement that, in fact, the world is still digesting today. In the past, in previous GATT rounds, most of the effort on negotiation and rulemaking had been around trade in industrialized goods. And that, of course, is of great interest to the affluent industrialized nations who were, in those days, the principal producers of these kinds of goods. But one of the many ambitions of the Uruguay round was to include other areas for the first time ever. So, for instance, trade in services. Now, that's a very hard thing to get your head around, you know, how are services traded? We can understand how goods are traded, and economists often define goods as something you could drop on your foot.
Right.
How do you trade a service?
Ouch.
You know, there was also an agreement on intellectual property rights, a very controversial agreement. There was also an agreement for the first time ever on liberalizing agriculture, or actually bringing agriculture into the rules of the trade system. This, too, was a signal achievement.
Strange that it would take so long for agriculture to come into the mix, given that poorer countries particularly would have little else other than perhaps mining goods to trade.
That's right. Poor countries, developing countries, could never compete with the very deep pockets of the US and the EU when it came to subsidizing exports. So these were all issues that were addressed in the Uruguay round. So what you had, instead of just the narrower focus on trade and goods, you had negotiations on trade and services, on trade and intellectual property, trade and agriculture, and a number of allied agreements. And together, this was what constituted the Grand Bargain.
Which was part of the Uruguay round, which led to the formation of the WTO, because the Uruguay round was the last round of the GATT. And the Doha round, which is the current round, was begun. The Doha round sounds like a cookie or a biscuit, but it's not, is it?
No.
So what is it exactly?
There had been an attempt in 1999 at the infamous Seattle meeting to launch the first round ever of multilateral trade negotiations under the then new World Trade Organization. Of course, what people will remember were the very violent protests against the launch of the round, not just from anti-globalization groups on the extreme, but also from development organizations that thought that developing countries had been given a raw deal in the Uruguay round, from trade unionists, from environmental groups, all of whom really had a lot of concerns about multilateral trade negotiations. In fact, that contributed to the failure of the WTO to launch the round, but also countries and governments that had come to the negotiations weren't really ready to launch the round. And in fact, the round wasn't launched until after the events of September 11 in 2001. And it was really that launch should be seen in the wreckage of September 11, because when we come to talk about the problems of the Doha round, this starts to become significant.
The European Union is seen as one member, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so all those, that collection of generally very wealthy countries is represented by one. In Googling around for this, for information for this episode, I came across the tidbit, which I believe is meant to be true, that it's in theory a one-member, one-vote system, but it's never been put to the vote. It's always been around consensus building. And so if the EU were, in fact, needing to vote one day, it would be shortchanged, would it not?
Eric, I commend you on your research. One of the great strengths of the World Trade Organization, and one of the things that makes it so different from, say, the IMF and the World Bank, where there is weighted voting, that is, the more money you put in, the bigger your vote is worth, was the view from the beginning that it would be one country, one vote. Now, one of the reasons why the GATT and now the WTO has never put things to the vote is because of the view that if the United States felt that its vote was as weighty as the vote of Liechtenstein, for instance, that the organization would lose legitimacy. The major players would just say, well, why are we going to be bound by this? And
yes,
that's the reason why consensus has always been the way of the WTO. So on the one hand, this is a great strength. The idea that nothing moves until everything is agreed is a great strength of the organization. Mm. But it is also one of the things now that is blocking progress in the Doha round negotiations. So it has now become, in a very large, complex, diverse organization, it has arguably become an obstacle.
You're listening to Up Close from the University of Melbourne, Australia. I'm Eric Van Bemmel. Our guest this episode is Professor Anne Capling, and we're discussing the past, present, and possible future of the World Trade Organization, or WTO. And to bring this sort of topic down to the retail individual level, how has it changed the lives of everyday people?
Oh, it has changed our lives immensely, of course, in ways that most of us would never realize. From, say, my position, sitting in an affluent country, but an unusual country in that most of its income comes from the export of commodities.
And we're talking about Australia.
And agriculture in Australia, that's right. I think that the inclusion, for instance, of agriculture into the rules of the WTO from the mid-1990s has made a significant difference to, for instance, the Australian wheat industry, because it is no longer now subject to these crippling subsidy wars between the US and the European Union that occurred in the 1980s that forced wheat prices, world wheat prices, so low that farmers couldn't get a good return in countries like Australia that couldn't afford to play the subsidy game. But it's also affected our lives in other ways. Again, to use an Australian example, and this would apply in many other countries, the sparkling wine that we used to drink to celebrate, for instance, the birth of a child.
Formerly known as champagne,
but no longer, except if it's French, and that is because of a WTO rule.
Oh, okay. Now I know who to blame.
That's right. Although I don't think it's dampened sales in Australia. So that's a little and maybe a trivial example, although it wouldn't have been trivial for the industries that are affected. But another example, when I moved to Australia from Canada in the mid-1980s, the price of cars was, I found it amazing and horrifying. Cars were very expensive in Australia, and that's because they were protected by very high levels of tariff and non-tariff protection. But again, because of Australia offered to reduce its tariffs on cars and make those part of its commitments in the Uruguay round, car prices now in Australia are as competitive as you would see anywhere in the world. And what's more, I can now buy cars made by manufacturers in Europe that are not available for sale to my former Canadian friends.
If we move on to the Doha round, often described by the press as sort of in trouble, as you say, it didn't happen, didn't start in earnest until after the events of 9/11, but it's now 2008. It was meant originally to complete in 2003. Tell us about the Doha round in a bit more detail. What's the problem with it?
The Doha round was probably the most ambitious agenda that had ever been put out there for trade negotiations. You take that, you take the fact that countries now are much more complacent about their opportunities to trade. A lot of the low-hanging fruit has already been picked. A lot of the easy liberalization has already happened. Mm. And what's still on the table is difficult liberalization, politically painful liberalization in areas such as agriculture, which is hotly opposed in the EU, for instance, and for political reasons is resisted in the United States. But also for developing countries, the rich countries are asking them to make big cuts in their tariffs on industrial products that they've been exempted from doing in the past. These are really difficult and demanding areas. When you add to that the fact that countries have loaded up the agenda with, you know, trade and the environment, and when you add to that the expectation, because it's called the Doha Development Round, that this round will deliver something extra and special for developing countries,
yes,
and you add the complicating fact that you've got 150-some-odd countries at the table, and then you add to that the fact that almost every government in the world, I think bar Mongolia, is busy negotiating so-called free trade agreements, you have a recipe for, I'd say, paralysis at best.
And you say free trade agreements. These are regional trade agreements, bilateral, plurilateral, to use one of my Google terms. is that right? These sort of ones that are more regional and not encompassing the entire global system.
Yes. Governments call them free trade agreements because they do involve more trade liberalization, usually between two countries.
An example being NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
That's right. The WTO, just to complicate things, calls them regional trade agreements, so RTAs. And people like me, who are critical of these agreements, call them preferential trade agreements because of their inherently preferential or discriminatory nature. That is, unlike agreements negotiated through the WTO, where if Australia, for instance, agrees to lower its tariff on car parts, it does it not just for car parts from the United States, it does it for car parts from every country in the world.
Or should, under a non-discriminatory
That's
regime.
That's right. Yes. But in a so-called free trade agreement, you're doing this preferentially. You're doing it for one country, the other party to the agreement, but not for all the other members of the multilateral trade system. So you're introducing an element of discrimination into your trade policies, which we were trying to overcome with multilateralism.
And these regional regimes would need to be taken down in order for a WTO sort of blanket agreement to be reached? Yeah?
No, not necessarily. And I think that most people now would say there are so many of these. There are hundreds and hundreds of these now in the world, and they've proliferated dramatically in the last 7 or 8 years, maybe in part because of the difficulty now of negotiating multilaterally. I think that most trade experts would agree that they will coexist now with the World Trade Organization. But the challenge, and one of the things that we talk about in the Warwick Commission report, the challenge here is how do you prevent all these preferential trade agreements from undermining support and the legitimacy of the multilateral trade system? How do you keep governments interested in putting energy and resources into both the WTO and preferential trade agreements?
Yes.
And how do you restrain the worst aspects of some of these preferential trade agreements?
I'm speaking with Professor Anne Capling, political scientist from the University of Melbourne. You're listening to Up Close. I'm Eric Van Bemmel. You and your Warwick colleagues named a number of challenges to the multilateral trade regime, one of them being to counter the growing opposition in industrialised countries to trade liberalisation, and specifically you said industrialised countries. Is there no opposition in industrialising countries?
That is one of the really interesting aspects of globalisation, say over the last 15 years. Just as developing countries are coming to realise the huge benefits of trade liberalisation, and in fact, many of them are now doing it unilaterally. They're lowering their tariffs. They're removing their barriers to trade and investment themselves. They're not negotiating this. Just as this is happening, and just as increasingly in developing countries, populations are becoming very supportive of globalization and believe it. The Gallup polls show that there's very strong support for globalization. Developing countries see this as good for them.
At a public grassroots level.
At a public grassroots level. At exactly the same time, we're starting to see, especially in North America and Western Europe, a backlash against globalization. One of the promises of trade liberalization is that, yes, there are always losers from trade liberalization. There are always industries that will be adversely affected, but, you know, there will be gains and there will be winners. And one of the problems is that governments are not managing the issue of losers very well.
Can I ask for an example of a loser?
Sure. Let's take in the US, for instance. One of the arguments would be, look, if you lower your tariffs on industrial products, yes, we're going to lose some manufacturing to lower wage locations in South America or Mexico or in Southeast Asia. But what you will get in return, for instance, is more and better jobs in areas that the economy is competitive. So in services, for instance, or in intellectual property. But, of course, what's happening is that many of those services jobs are now being offshored to places like India. So, for instance, call centers or the more highly educated jobs, software development, is moving from Silicon Valley to India. And so Americans will turn around and say, hey, you know, we knew we were going to lose our textile factories and we knew we were going to lose our steel industry, but there was never anything on the table about losing our software development industry. So, you know, you could say, well, that's exactly the way comparative advantage works. That's the way trade liberalization works. On the other hand, maybe the problem is that the social safety nets in the U.S. are not adequate, that income distribution is not done in an equitable way, that the losers aren't being properly compensated by governments. And this is one of the things that governments actually could do something about in managing the downsides of globalization.
But that's seen as internal sort of interference, isn't it, for the WTO to suggest?
Yeah, the WTO can't suggest that. But it's much easier for many groups to turn around and say it's the WTO's fault.
Yes.
People like to find a reason for their grief. And because it's very easy to accuse the WTO of all sorts of things, even though in fact it's governments, there is no such thing as some sort of separate WTO out there that makes up rules and forces them on governments. Every rule, every agreement was negotiated among governments.
Yes.
So when you're, you know, when you're mad at the WTO, you're actually mad at your own government.
Your colleagues also came up with a number of recommendations. One I think that needs a bit of expanding is the Warwick Commission is recommending that there is less reliance or no more reliance on consensus decision making in future negotiations. Better to look at what's called critical mass decision making. Can you explain a bit about that?
Sure. One of the great outcomes of the Uruguay round was what they called the single undertaking. That is, everybody agreed to everything and agreed to adopt it. And so, for instance, there was nothing agreed in the services negotiations or the trade negotiations until there was an agreement in agriculture and so on. And that allowed countries to make linkages between areas, make trade-offs. And it was seen as highly important to the negotiating process to be, you know, the agreement on agriculture was made possible because the U.S. could turn around to its farmers and say, but we're getting really good stuff on intellectual property rights in return. So, you know, but the problem is that that approach is now holding up the Doha round negotiations. This is probably one of the things that has now made it impossible because all it takes is one country to say, nah, we're not going to go along with that. And then there is no consensus.
It amounts to a veto almost.
It amounts to a veto. And it can be a tiny country that uses the veto. Right now, it's the large countries all sort of in a standoff against each other. So I think the Warwick Commission felt that we needed to think about the way decision-making occurs in the WTO to overcome the sort of impasse that we expect would be more likely now, given the complexity and the size and the diversity of the membership. Again, this wasn't a new recommendation, but I think what was quite good about our proposals was the idea that there would be very tight conditions about when a subset of the membership could come to an agreement. So you would come to an agreement, but all 150-odd members would not be compelled to implement, whether that's a rule change or a tariff cut. It wouldn't be incumbent on everybody. It would only be incumbent on the volunteers to
do
this.
And apply only to the volunteers?
Applied only to the volunteers, but with some very important caveats. First of all, countries involved in a critical mass negotiation or agreement would have to, first of all, establish that the agreement was going to contribute overall to net global welfare. Another caveat would be that the agreement would have to be multilateralized. That is, the obligations of the agreement would be assumed only by those who chose to sign up to it, but the benefit would be there for all other members, regardless of whether they were signatories or not. Another caveat would be that any country that wanted to join at a later date would be able to do so without any additional obligations or conditions being imposed on them. So what we're trying to do is to break away from this idea that 150-odd countries have to agree before the members can move forward on something. And
yes,
we're trying to think of a way of having an agreement that still is to the overall benefit of the multilateral trade system, is to the overall benefit of global welfare, and doesn't in any way discriminate against those who feel that for whatever reason they can't sign on to it at that current point.
Another recommendation was around aid for trade. What does that mean?
It's in the interest of developing countries to be able to participate more effectively and more broadly in the trade system. And that's one of the things that stops them from doing that right now is not just, for instance, the still relatively weak treatment of agriculture in international trade rules compared to the treatment of industrialized products, but rather problems to do with lack of infrastructure, lack of roads, you know, lack of harbor facilities, lack of administrative know-how to be able to efficiently process imports and exports. So there's very much a view that these issues that they call trade facilitation could be funded by developed countries as a way of assisting developing countries to participate more fully in the trade system. Mm-hmm. And this is very important as an engine for growth. And so aid for trade is about not aid for poverty alleviation, but aid to help countries participate more effectively. We presented a number of recommendations that talked about a role for the WTO that wouldn't see it responsible for ensuring that governments stuck to their commitments, but would give it a role in being able to, in a sense, collect data on what was happening and to be able to introduce some level of transparency about what was happening in aid for trade.
I'll just very briefly mention a couple of other things that were recommended by the Warwick Commission: an increasing of financial compensation as a way to resolve disputes, and also what was called a high-level reflection exercise on the future of the trade system. And I guess that's having governments of member states think very carefully about what they want from world trade and to recommit themselves to WTO.
This idea of a period of critical reflection, I think we're recommending strongly that this happens regardless of whether the round ends in failure or ends in success. Today's leaders have, in a sense, lost sight of the lessons of the past. They've lost sight of why, where the idea for an international, multilateral, non-discriminatory trade institution came from. And I think we had a view that it's taken for granted now, and that, in fact, the world is at risk, certainly in good times, but in bad times. And bad times will most surely come. We know this from the broader course of economic history. what might happen if, in fact, the world is left with these preferential and discriminatory trade arrangements as its default? What will happen if governments turn away from the WTO? They say, oh, that's all too hard, negotiations take too long. Does that delegitimize the institution as a whole? Does that delegitimize its role as a rulemaker or a place where governments can negotiate conflict or negotiate their differences? I think that there's a great risk that the institution is being taken for granted while there are good times. And what the idea of a period of critical reflection was precisely that, to get the 150-odd members to really think about, what does the institution mean to it? What value does it have? Where are the areas where it might be drifting? And do they want to recommit to the organization?
Anne Capling, Melbourne University Professor of Politics and Warwick Commission member, thanks for your time today.
A pleasure.
Melbourne University Up Close comes to you from the Marketing and Communications Division in association with Asia Institute of the University of Melbourne, Australia. Relevant links, a full transcript, and more information on this episode can be found on our website at upclose.unimelb.edu.au. We also invite you to leave your comments or feedback on this or any other episode of Up Close. Simply click on the Add Comment link at the bottom of the episode page. This episode was produced by Kelvin Parham and myself, Eric Van Bemmel. Audio recording by Russell Evans. Theme music performed by Sergio Ercole. Melbourne University Up Close is created by Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Parham. Until next time, goodbye.
You've been listening to Melbourne University Up Close, a fortnightly podcast of research, personalities and cultural offerings of the University of Melbourne, Australia. Up Close is available on the web at upclose.unimelb.edu.au. That's upclose.unimelb.edu.au. Copyright 2008, University of Melbourne.